Yeah, I both really good questions. I'll take the last one first. Sort of, doesn't the obsolescence or this kind of vacancy chain of tenants moving from older buildings to newer buildings sort of open up opportunities for exciting new uses and sort of create, a more diverse central business district? And certainly we saw, that's one of the other sort of stories of the Loop during this period, is that the Loop started or regained some of its retail activity, and more importantly, I think sort of it's institutional uses. So the universities and museums and some of the dorms for the students, and some of these were in older buildings, but some of them were in newly constructed buildings as well. And that's also part of the story, and that's one of the sort of exciting things about obsolescence. And I have a chapter in my book that sort of talks about, so it's not all obsolete buildings just get exploded, wither and die, sort of fall in on themselves and go back to nature and start being taken over by plants and trees, and especially for people who are interested in sort of DIY sort of cultures, is that those, like the old industrial loft buildings, were taken over and turned into dance clubs and art galleries, and that's all things that planners and people tend to applaud as a good thing. What I found took place in the Loop was that even though there were some examples of this, it wasn't that sort of happened across the board, and that just as often older buildings seem to be torn down to make way for new construction. There's sort of like there's also sort of a decision point at which you just say it's still going to be better to build new. And if you look at the numbers, and I was surprised by this because it certainly feels as just sort of walking around the Loop that the character has changed so much, and you see so many more students, and but office still is the same share of total construction as it was before this boom. Right, you thought that maybe the offices being, or those kinds of commercial uses being crowded out by some of these new institutional uses, but it still seems like office is sort of just as important. So maybe that's part of the nature of sort of there's more available space to be occupied. So I'm not exactly sure why the sort of numbers don't seem to conform to what everybody generally feels has been this really sort of major trend downtown. I'm not saying that this is necessarily a horrible thing, right? That there's this kind of, but rather sort of pointing out more of the dynamics and offering some insight into sort of when buildings that otherwise might be classified as obsolete or having no value or should be coming down, when they get sort of reappropriated and kind of come back even stronger, or come back and have all this sort of cultural cachet. What I did find was that the developers, and sort of looking at this more from a supply side perspective, the developers who take on those kinds of projects are very different from the developers that I was looking at. So the John Bucks of the world and the the Alter groups. It's the developers who take on a project to convert an older existing commercial building either into condos, to convert it into residential, or just to convert it into sort of higher, to rehab it, so it's just sort of higher quality office space. They're really small, and they're very local. There's a company a developer out of Michigan that's gotten into a lot of trouble recently called Village Green, which I think is great just for the name, right? So it's like they're taking on the sort of nostalgia projects, and they're not getting money from the big guys either. They're not getting money from like the money center banks that are funding the new office construction. They're getting money from very small, local, regional kinds of banks, and they're getting it's hard to do those projects, right? The money is not as forthcoming, and they have a much harder case making, much harder time making the kind of case for why the project should be built. So all the big bankers that I was talking to, and I asked, well, what about this building over here, or could this be rehab? And again, sort of wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. And then your first question is sort of the one that I'm constantly struggling with, which is trying to kind of go into this issue with this is sort of more of a social science kind of lens, and looking at the sort of way in which this abstraction, this construct of obsolescence gets deployed. It's so hard not to see all the sort of, the sort of social value that's inherited it, but there's also sort of a technical basis for that, right? And there may be very sort of material reasons why you want to move from an older building to a new one that relate to things like energy costs and the ability to have more energy efficient space. And that's it seems like when I would actually go into the talk to developers about the sort of numbers and sort of the way they would make that kind of calculus is that there was often sort of a big gray area about whether or not it was worth it for them to just rehab, or the owner to rehab the building to occupy it at a higher price versus actually moving to new space. That there's still in that decision, I would argue, a lot of play, a lot of sort of room for these kinds of social conventions and issues that are sort of can be less boiled down to a pure sort of cost benefit type of agreement or cost benefit analysis to be made.
I'm just wondering if the people you would interview on that topic would not necessarily be the bankers or the top end of the developers, mm-hmm. but let's say the project managers mm-hmm. who run getting one of those buildings constructed, mm-hmm. who are really dealing with, that's more of the construction managers, project managers, some aspects of the architecture. Like they're different, they're a different body of people mm-hmm. who are addressing that issue.
Thank you. That's a good suggestion.
Yeah. So I guess I don't know if your study ended in 2008, but it would be interesting if you could speak a little bit about how some of those institutional relations and kind of everyday taken for granted understandings have shifted mm-hmm. as a result of the crisis in any or all three of those fields.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, there's certainly sort of a lot of, it's an interesting field, and I imagine that a lot of fields are like this, but when things go wrong, when things are going great, there's a lot of desire to take credit, right? And it's when you talk to real estate developers, it's all sort of story of this, very willing to take risks, spatial visionaries, and I did it on my own, and I'm this lone wolf, and everybody told me it could be done, and I went for it anyways, and that's why I'm Sam Zell, or I'm Donald Trump, to use a more popular example. So you talk about it in this very sort of individual manner, and then things go wrong. And it all of a sudden it becomes this sort of collective problem. And it's system-wide defects and, feedback loops that were poorly designed and information that circulated that shouldn't have circulated. And so, yeah, I've continued to do these interviews after the markets crashed, after the credit crisis. And I've actually found that it's sort of relatively easy to get people to open up because there's a desire to sort of show that I wasn't personally culpable, and it's this, or it's, and it's also, as I said, it's easier for them, I think, to think socially in a time when they want to sort of avoid accepting, or sort of placing blame on any one individual sort of actor, sort of piece of this system. But yeah, I'm asking them still about the. That would be a whole other book, but it would be very interesting to sort of see how they sort of talk about these sort of buildings and space and in kind of in a sort of crisis mode, but I'm trying to get them to sort of think back to brighter days. And it's, I think having a little bit of temporal distance makes it a little bit easier. And like I said, I think this desire to sort of find collective fault with the problem rather than sort of internalize it individually.
I understand that your project is mainly about Chicago, especially the Loop area in Chicago. But do you think we can consider Chicago actually as a special case in itself in terms of the land speculation, or it actually can have broader implications? To understand this kind of urban renewal or the booming of the financial area or this kind of obsolescence also in other cities. In other words, is there something special about Chicago here, mm-hmm. or something more general from Chicago about other cities?
Yeah, I'd like to think that it's generalizable because then maybe more people will read the book than people who are interested in Chicago. So I'd like to say it's a generalizable phenomenon, but I know that that's not the case. I think that certain elements of this certainly you can see in so many other cities, but there's going to be, the sort of main distinctions, I think, between places are sort of the extent to which the land markets are regulated and to what extent the folks who control that regulation want to, you know, want to grow the city, you know, and sort of max it out versus want to kind of contain it. And you find sort of different attitudes toward growth and therefore different desires to either sort of contain this, you know, the sort of frenzy versus to kind of enhance and enable it. You know, I think a lot of the sort of financial market regulations are less spatially contingent. I think those sort of operate more kind of at a national level. I think they're sort of, even though there are some distinctions, and I've written a little bit about this in terms of sort of a city's relationship to the bond market, that those are different to the ability of municipalities to raise money to help subsidize some of this development is different, right? Cities have different bond ratings. They're less aggressive in terms of going after some of this money. So there's sort of different stances that local governments can take. People have asked me, could Chicago have done something to, is there some lever that the city could have pulled to stop this? And I guess my response would be, you know, why would it have wanted to, right? It didn't really, it was expensive from the city's perspective. The city spent a lot of money downtown, a lot of money that, you know, now just like these developers and financial market actors are having a hard time, obviously cities are really struggling fiscally, and maybe because they overreached during this period as well. So I guess that's a long answer to say, like, I do think that there are sort of differences, and in Chicago there was a real sort of emphasis on growth and development, and talking to planners who worked for the city during this time, there was a sense of, like, we want to encourage all this new construction. However, we want to try to manage this process enough so that there can be green roofs and certain kinds of aesthetic details. So the city was very interested in tall, skinny buildings during this time. So they pushed back through what's called a plan development process, which is kind of like a separate zoning overlay where the zoning becomes a little bit more negotiated. So the city planners kind of went back and forth with the developers and architects trying to sort of affect the kind of envelope, the aesthetic sort of the value of these buildings, but it ultimately wanted them built and it did what it could to make sure that could happen. Even though the process of getting, you know, the entitlements and the approvals, building permits and everything is, I don't want to make that seem like it was just, you know, you walk in and you get it. That's an onerous process. But I think more because the city wanted to control certain aspects of it, not because they wanted to stem the new development, new construction.
Is there tentative date for the publishing of this future book?
If you want to provide free research assistance, it would come out a lot more quickly.
I didn't know if that's a question that she asked.
That's a good question. You know, probably sometime next year I'll try to send it off and be done with it. Maybe I'm speculating.
Had you looked into whether there was a net increase in the amount of floor space that these different companies actually used in the new buildings, and whether that net increase was sustained over, say, a five-year period of time?
Actually, it seemed that the new when tenants were moving from one building to a new building, they tended to consume less space because of just sort of changes in, this is where it can get back to sort of the material, kind of the use of space and the configuration of space. So law firms, for example, don't need law libraries anymore, right? That's all computerized. It's on your computer. Mayor Brown, they're building at, I forgot what, LaSalle, they had three floors devoted to a law library. That became obsolete, mm-hmm. right? There's an example of sort of technological obsolescence. They didn't need three floors for it. So they actually consumed less space. Mm-hmm. And then they moved to a system where the managing partners didn't have their own sort of big corner offices. There was a much sort of more of a kind of democratization of space. There were more meeting rooms and things instead of individual sort of private offices. So it ended up actually, even though they didn't shed any of their employees around that time, they actually needed much less floor space, which is again one of the reasons why there's such a kind of frenzy of leasing, because then you had to sort of occupy, you'd find new tenants to sort of occupy some of the space that they didn't need.
Yeah, I have a question that's related to a previous one about applying these results to other geographies. Maybe this is your next book, but what's your sense of how these financial and other trends related to obsolescence might apply to a Schaumburg or kind of an edge city? And has there been the same kind of obsolescence and devaluing of older buildings?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, because in a lot of these places, there aren't as many older buildings. Like there, like the Schaumburgs and the Elk Grove Villages and the, you know, the sort of office agglomerations along I-88 or up near O'Hare, those were relatively new, right? So you've got sort of newer buildings, but you just, there is still, that's why I think the concept of obsolescence is so interesting, because you can have relatively recently built buildings still being sort of devalued or sort of written off as not being sort of high-tech enough or modern enough. And I think you see what's happening in the Loop in some ways in a more extreme form in those places. I think that the suburban office market was definitely harder hit than the Loop market. I mean, that's, Chicago's rare in that a lot of its office activity is still concentrated downtown. In a lot of other cities, those suburban office parks have done a lot better. And a lot of them, there's been, so we've managed to sort of hold on to a lot of our office tenants in a way better than both the suburban office markets and some other major cities. But you certainly see a lot of those sort of green glass buildings along I-88 with big, you know, for sale or for rent signs. So my impression is that vacancy rates are a lot higher in those places, that the Loop's actually done comparatively well relative to those spaces. And that's, those spaces, I think, have a harder time being repurposed, right? You're pretty isolated when you're in, you know, Oak Brook, you know, along the highway. It's not as if, I mean, I'm sure there are certain tenants that want to, non-office tenants that would want to locate there, but the advantages of sort of urban agglomeration and density are that there's sort of a potential for a more diverse set of uses to occupy that space in the when those buildings are hurting.
I have a few questions. How would your work compare to, or what you just discussed in the past 20 years of real estate speculation, how would that compare to more historic trends of real estate speculation? Because some of the stuff you're talking about, obsolescence, isn't anything new, because Arthur Rubloff in the 30s, when he acquired the Masonic Temple, kind of convinced the organization that the building was, to some extent, obsolete, inefficient, and somewhat compromised by the State Street subway. So he was able to demolish that and build what would be called a taxpayer, like a two-story retail building, which existed until only a couple of years ago. Are there any differences in like the general trend? Is this like a continuation?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if that was the 1930s, but I think there was, you know, certainly I think you see these kinds of trends taking place when there's some sort of innovation in financial instruments. And during the 1920s, there was, you know, in the same way where there are sort of parallels to the securitization of mortgages, there was sort of mortgage bonds that were purchased by, you know, the Brahmin banks in Boston for Chicago real estate. And I think that was one of the fact that there, you know, you made real estate a more liquid commodity, a more liquid asset, so you could have, in this case, not so much global investors, I don't think they're global investors, but you should have a national investment market for urban real estate. So there's more money being pumped into cities, more buildings being built, and I think you see that same sort of trend. I mean, there was an architectural historian, a PhD student, who did a study of demolitions during the 1930s. And her argument is that it's related to sort of different kinds of assessment techniques and sort of the all over the placeness of the valuations and the property taxes that you owed. But in some ways, you could argue that this is also sort of the overhang of this kind of finance-fueled construction and acquisition frenzies, that a lot of buildings were sort of left over once the tenants had moved, and you had sort of vacant or underutilized space after that.
And then how would overhang kind of, with your studies, how does that affect, say, local businesses, or like, well, I'm thinking of specifically retail businesses, because the one thing I've known in paying attention to a Loop for my 25 years is really the loss of a really vibrant retail district in kind of a, where it was like locally owned independent stores that which are more interesting to shop at, but it's also too meant that when you bought something, the capital went into the city to some extent, or it went to someone who was local versus a transformation into something that was more like a big box store. It's like a local clothing store, say going to like an Old Navy. And to some extent, I'm kind of using it as like a representative because it's like how real estate speculation and redevelopment has kind of created something which like the smaller players are being left out at. It's like kind of what you said, it's like an abstraction.
Yeah, I think you could read what the story I just told in terms of, I mean, I'm not calling it this, but a kind of business gentrification story. And with a lot of the sort of Class C and B buildings, you know, these are office buildings that provided space for the, you know, the solo law practitioner or the individual medical practice, and a lot of nonprofit organizations, a lot of business, a lot of nonprofits that are in the field of planning occupied a lot of the buildings that then went condo. They converted to condo, or they were demolished, or they were upgraded with such high rents that these businesses couldn't afford to live there. So I think that you know, during these building booms, you see this sort of generalized appreciative effect, and the folks whose businesses aren't able to keep up with that, who can't pay the extra rent or can't afford the rising prices. I mean, so there's a parallel with a kind of residential market. Have to find, you know, some new space, and it becomes harder and harder as a lot of these Class C and B buildings aren't doing as well. In some ways, though, you could argue that they might benefit from it because these are buildings that are, if they are devalued, then you'd expect to see their rents be relatively low. But they're also more vulnerable. They're vulnerable, and we did a study a couple of years ago. We didn't publish this, but found that the occupants of a lot of these Class C buildings make a lot of moves, right? So they're often having to move from one building to another. Well, you know, we don't, what the motivation for that is, you know, we're only sort of speculating, we're only guessing that it was this sort of, that, you know, there's a lot of sort of change at that sort of the bottom of the food chain. And so that they often didn't have sort of relatively stable digs, or it's harder for them to achieve some sort of semblance of sort of stability, given that there was plans to demolish this building, or plans to turn it into a condo, or turn it into a hotel. So I think, you know, it's another way of reading this, but it's not the way that I've sort of chosen to look at it. But I definitely think that there's a relevance to that kind of interpretation. Simone?
You had mentioned that there was a lot of residential building being done. So could you have told the same story in terms of that residents then left a lot of the older buildings, they were demolished, or was there a shifting then, what you were talking about in terms of lower rents, so that a shifting of populations in terms of social class to different areas because of this building boom? And what percentage was actually residential to commercial?
Yeah, I didn't take a look at that specifically, but I think there is a parallel in the study of sort of gentrification and housing market analysis, sometimes called filtering, and sort of the movement up and what happens at the low end. Do the rents come down enough so that we have all of a sudden a surplus of affordable housing? Or do the owners of that space, you know, speculate and continue to sort of hold it vacant, hoping that there will be a moment when the rents can eventually go up? But I definitely, you know, I think that's why we think about growth. We don't necessarily see the sort of transformative, the sort of redistributional effects that it has when you add a new building, when the market's relatively flat, right? When there's no new entrance to a market, and you add new buildings, those people are going to have to come from somewhere, right? So there's sort of a substitution effect. So which neighborhoods in the city of Chicago sort of lost population so that folks could move to the downtown high-rises? And is that a problem? Were those places then sort of occupied by people who wanted to move to the places that they had, the older buildings that they had vacated? It's not clear. It's a little bit of a game of musical chairs that doesn't quite end, so you can't really sort of see where everything, it's a moving target, so you can't really see sort of how it all played out. But I think on a municipal level, well, we've been, I was sitting talking to somebody at CMAP, the Chicago Metropolitan Agency for Planning, and they were saying that this is sort of what they see is happening in terms of suburbs. There's been a fair amount of musical chairs that the returnees to the city, to the central city, again, they're coming from somewhere, and their hypothesis is that it's a lot of the sort of inner ring suburbs that are losing population, especially higher income population. And that there's sort of a demographic shifts that are taking place in the suburb as a result of sort of the vacating of a lot of the, in particular, sort of older housing stock. Yes?
You mentioned that Chicago was part of a global financial system that encouraged real estate development speculation. That implies that Chicago also had municipal peers and that there were metrics which define what how Chicago is measured up against these against its peers. How did where was Chicago within its peer group? What were its peers? And how well did those peers perform post boom versus how Chicago's performed?
I think that in some ways Chicago's managed to Chicago didn't overbuild to the extent that so many other cities did. Now that could have been just the result of, you know, less space to do that, or there was less interest in building here. Or, you know, I don't really think it had to do with sort of regulatory hurdles and barriers as much, because I think they were pretty, you know, against supportive of the new development. But if you look at a table like this, you see that places like Atlanta, Dallas, Washington, D.C. added a lot more. They were more transformed. They added a lot more sort of rentable building area. And I believe this is net of demolitions. So this is sort of net new growth. So again,
it's not a whole screen.
Oh. I'm assuming you're all looking at this. You're like following along with me. Thanks. Okay, sorry, you can't see that. I don't know where
I can turn it back on.
I don't know what's going on. I'm sure. You want to turn it back? That might. Oh. So Chicago didn't overbuild as much, and I think when people talk about what the boom was, they talk about it in terms of some overbuilding and overcapacity, but almost more in terms of it was a pricing boom, like the rates of appreciation were the sort of most astounding things, not the like sheer amount of space that was put onto the market. You know, but those kinds of rates of appreciation were also seen in pretty much every one of these markets, D.C. in particular, and New York in particular. You know, New York, again, you see like there was actually a negative, even though there's so many new buildings built in New York, there's no space to build them. It's also a function of the way CoStar, which is the source of the data, sort of looks at the individual markets. And for New York, it's a much more sort of tightly constrained limited geography. But for every new building that was put up, a building had to come down. So there's sort of a loss of rentable building area. New York kind of came out sort of where it was in between 1998 and 2008. And relatively strict, I guess, zoning that didn't allow the floor area ratios to sort of extend much higher than they were previous to that. But in terms of sort of comparing how Chicago fared in the aftermath, again, the market seems to have, I'm not going to say rebounded, but it's kind of stabilized in ways that markets in the Southwest, particularly California, Texas, Arizona, Florida, have not come back. So again, I don't have a thesis for why that is or what kind of, you know, sort of what was causing that kind of restraint, but I think it's partly due to the fact that it didn't sort of overbuild to the extent that those markets did. Dennis?
If whim, sentiment, hysteria, and status anxiety are inherent to booms, property booms, is there any conceivable regulation that can rein those impulses in, or should they be reined in?
Yeah, it's kind of the million-dollar question.
There's can they be reined in?
Yes. I mean, I think that there were, you know, I think that there were, there are certain sort of financial market regulatory changes or, you know, reforms that you could make that would make it a little harder to securitize all of these loans, which then means that the real estate, investing in real estate is not as easy and, you know, accessible for the average for the average Joe. So, you know, that's, so I think that there are ways in which you can kind of slow things down, right? You can kind of turn this sort of fast-paced transactional activity, you can kind of, you can slow it down. The question is, would you want to, right? So that's the, and that's the question that Elizabeth Warren and everybody else is involved in thinking about, thinking through financial market reforms is considering now. You know, sort of when does it get, when is it healthy to have this kind of activity and to have these sort of more liquid markets, right? So, you know, one of the reasons why their securitization was, you know, through the, through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mae and the government-sponsored enterprises that created more of a market that allowed lower-income households to buy homes. So it created a more, you create a more liquid market, you're enabling people to purchase homes, and that was not necessarily a bad thing. And in my last chapter of the book, I'm exploring these very issues, sort of whether or not we should be trying to encourage a kind of slow building movement, whether or not it's better to have, you know, in some ways a kind of a more European model where there's, where a building is so heavily regulated that you have to take stock of the stock that you have. You invest in older buildings because you can't build new. These kinds of vacancy chains and sort of frenzied transactions aren't allowed to happen. And many people argue that that's it's a kind of elitist, you know, like it's a way to sort of save old buildings for wealthy people. And you make housing costs higher, and you create, you know, it's more expensive to get into those heavily regulated markets. So there's sort of trade-offs, right, in terms of democracy, access, and change. And so that's what I'm trying to sort of trying to point out in this last chapter. Fran.
In terms of IT issues, I mean, so in competing on IT issues with India, Africa, and other less developed countries, it's much harder to develop capacity for computers and whatever is going to be in the future. So that if one were going to just recap what's the cost of making buildings competitive for the future. I mean, people like people downtown in the stock exchange, I mean, they're in some ways at a disadvantage in competing with less developed countries in their markets. So it's not just Europe, but it's...
Kind of getting back to this question that Sharon asked, sort of like there's a very sort of technical way of determining whether or not it makes sense to retrofit an older building or to build new. Right? There's that sort of price at which it makes sense to just, you know, sort of abandon the ship and build new versus whether or not it makes sense to reinvest in an existing building. And I think that in addition to sort of energy efficiency issues, there is a sort of the wired issue. Whether
it's
or not
the infrastructure, so that
infrastructure
if you build out someplace else, you can start to scratch. I mean, so it's a real, I mean, you know, it's more than just the building and the site, it's the location and the infrastructure of older urban areas.
But I will bring this example, and you might think this is kind of a wacky example. But think of the most sort of obsolete piece of built environment or technology you can think of. I think of the High Line in New York, right? You have an abandoned rail, elevated rail track in New York. So there's no use for that. There's no elevated train in New York anymore. So that is just, it's you know, you can't get sort of a better example of obsolescence than that. And yet, look what happened with the political will and the a lot of private sponsorship and a lot of you know, high-profile residents of the West Village, like Sarah Jessica Parker coming out, and you're able to transform that into a pretty amazing and very highly valued by residents of New York and by tourists piece of the urban environment. So there's sort of a question of, there's the, like, how much money, is it a purely financial decision, or is it a, there's also sort of a decision of sort of the political will. And I guess I use that example just to say that that I think that there's sort of these sort of different kinds of decision points that take place, or different kinds of decisions that take place when deciding whether or not to hold on to or abandon. And it seems to me sort of that it's rarely simply, you know, a financial or a technical issue, like I think the case of the High Line sort of illustrates. Yes.
Domestic. Or not domestic, a local example of what you just said, it's like trying to maintain obsolescence or reuse of obsolescence. I'm going to say what I really think. It's reuse of a historic object, adaptive reuse. Say, Chicago's decision not to rezone the Spice District. How do you think that would kind of help, say, keep like an island of like light industry kind of... Because the way, for me, what I think what the intent was to kind of keep that as like one area, so when those few buildings there wouldn't have their main historic character, they wouldn't be redeveloped into condos. I think there's a better reason to kind of, better benefit of why that happened, is so that way you have a space that's close to the loop for light industrial uses, kind of like how everything around this building we're sitting in, how these used to be all factories and such. And then now they're gone condo. This will be one place that won't have that happen. As like,
yeah, there's sometimes very good sort of economic reasons to preserve, right? There's there could be, you know, in the case of the planned manufacturing districts that the city has that are sort of on the periphery of the loop. Those are ways that the city kind of came in and said, tried to. Sort of stave off change and try to sort of stabilize and sort of retain those uses, even though the market was pressuring those industrial owners of those industrial buildings to convert to residential uses. And the buildings that can, the businesses that can afford to operate in those areas have done very well. There's a lot of good reasons why you want to be close to the city center. And so a lot of reasons why there's sort of older buildings and older infrastructure. You know, the sort of economic advantages don't just disappear with time. And then there are reasons, you know, related to tourism and sort of the maintenance of the kind of, you know, the sort of Jane Jacobsian diversity of facades and uses. And a lot of people find that areas that have a little bit more of that kind of historical content can be more interesting. But that's not, you know, those aren't always, that's oftentimes not good enough reasons just to sort of hold on to the building stock. I mean, if you're just sort of maintaining the facades just because they look pretty, or they, but they don't necessarily have any kind of functional use or value, or the market that would occupy them has sort of abandoned them for the corporate, you know, office park in the suburbs, then there's sort of a question of, this is why I like the field of planning. You have to make those kinds of decisions, and those, they're not clear cut at all.
Mm-hmm. Question? Well, thank you so much for your time.